Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Rolling Stone Show here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Steve Godwin, and over this next hour, I'll be reading from the online edition of Rolling Stone magazine. And right now, I'm going to flip over to the subculture section. The Mad Scientist and the Killer Whales by Thomas Weber. The five animals took an hour to put the sailboat beneath the waves. At the end of October 2022, 4 men, each in his late 20s, set sail from western France toward Lisbon. Augustin Drion, an experienced sailor from Brittany, was one of them. He'd come to lend a hand to a friend from engineering school, Elliot Boyard, who owned the 39-foot sailing vessel. From Portugal, they planned to cross the Atlantic to the Caribbean. They would cruise around the islands for a year, and then they would return home. The crew had spent several days battling thunderstorms and high waves in the Bay of Biscay, the treacherous stretch of ocean to the west of France. They felt ragged. But on the morning after Halloween, the boat, called Smous, crossed into the stiller waters off Portugal, and the crew was able to relax. The sun was shining. The breeze was soft, and the boat was making 7 knots. For the first time, conditions were calm enough to rely on the autopilot. Drion had just finished a watch shift and decided to join the others lounging on deck. He ducked inside the cabin to grab a book. Then he heard a crash. The boat shook, and Drion lost his balance. "What happened?" he shouted up to the others. There was banging on the hull from the outside. The crew looked over the side and saw black fins breaking the glassy surface. 5 killer whales, each more than half the length of the boat, their glossy skin shining in the sunlight, were taking turns swimming into the back of the sailboat, ramming the rudder with their heads. With each crash, the boat jolted into a new direction. The crew shut down the electronics and hauled in the mainsail. Speeding off, they thought, would be an invitation to chase. The animals were faster. Better to stay put, quiet, and still. They sat without talking for almost an hour, drifting in open ocean. The only sounds were the deep, steady blows of orca breath, the clicks and whistles of killer whale language, the crunch of several tons of marine mammal, the boat weighed about the same as one adult male, against their rudder. After a while, Drion began to worry about the boat's structural integrity. He went down into the cockpit. This time, there was water on the floor. A steady stream flowed in from a crack in the stern. The boat was quickly flooding, and it was starting to sink. Boyard put out a mayday call. The nearest vessel was 60 minutes away, and the men inflated the lifeboat. They wanted to stay on the sinking boat for as long as possible, worried that the orcas might decide to sink their little craft too, which would be catastrophic. But the water was rising quickly, and they all crowded into the blow-up dinghy. They looked around. The killer whales had gone. A Swedish yacht arrived to pick them up. The men watched the top of the sailboat's mast disappear beneath the swells. Orcas very rarely go for boats. That's supposed to be the idea, but something new is happening off the Iberian coast. Since 2020, from the top of Portugal down to southern Spain, sailors have reported almost 1,000 similar attacks. Almost every day, every spring and summer, yarns from anguished captains attaching photos of their beat-up rudders fill up a Facebook group called Orca Attack Reports, which has more than 60,000 members. The epicenter of the carnage is the Strait of Gibraltar. The slim stretch of sea between Spain and Morocco, the gateway to the Mediterranean, is one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. Many captains now carry illicit firecrackers on board to throw at the whales. Some blast death metal on Bluetooth speakers. Others bash steel sticks against their hulls when orcas approach. Orcas have sunk at least 3 boats and damaged hundreds more. Nobody has died. Wild orcas, as far as we know, have never killed a human being. But sailors worry it's just a matter of time, while orca biologists are anxious about captains arming themselves and taking things into their own hands. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not too long before we see someone attempting to shoot one of these animals, says Luke Rendell, a marine mammal expert at the University of St. Andrews. The group of orcas that live around the Iberian Peninsula are the only killer whales that attack boats, and researchers know very little about them. There is only one scientific paper about their new hobby. The Portuguese government has advised sailors to stop moving if killer whales hit them and wait for them to get bored, which is what Drion and Boyard did instinctively. The Spanish authorities, though, say keep going. In 2020, the Spanish government banned small sailing boats from a part of northwestern Spain. Meanwhile, the attacks are spreading. This community of orcas, documented in the Strait of Gibraltar since the Roman Empire, consists of nearly 90 animals. Some scientists believe that all of them now ram sailing boats. What triggered the behavior is unclear. One hypothesis, though, has taken off. The orcas are seeking revenge. Orcas that have been documented attacking boats are called Gladys, G-L-A-D-I-S, from Orca Gladiator, one of the whale's scientific names. Killer whales move around in matrilineal units, a mother with up to 4 generations of descendants. We don't know which whale, or even which unit, was the first to start swimming into sailboats. Some believe it began in 2020 with Gladys Black, a male juvenile with a deep scar on his back from a wound, probably from a boat. Other researchers say it was Gladys White, an adult female from another unit. But whichever was the first, the others quickly began to copy them. The notion of killer whales with vendettas against humans, whether for injuring them with boat propellers or for picking their tuna hunting grounds clean or for ruining the climate or for capturing their brothers and sisters and imprisoning them in swimming pools, took the internet by storm last summer. You can buy stickers and mugs of the Gladys Orcas. Fuck them boats. Eat the rich. Support for Comrade Gladys. But these aren't super yachts. The orcas tend to leave fishing boats alone, too. The targets include humble craft, sailing boats of the kind you can buy for the cost of a cheap used car. For their owners and crew, many of whom are not, by sailing standards, especially wealthy, the attacks are terrifying. The most recent sinking was last October. There is no reliable way to deter them, and sailors are completely at their mercy. Which is why, in January 2022, the Spanish government asked Renaud de Stefanis, a 48-year-old Spanish orca expert, to figure out a solution to the problem. De Stefanis, who has a grizzled beard, shaggy hair, and bronzed, aging surfer skin, has been studying this group of orcas since the 1990s. Last December, I flew to Gibraltar, crossed the border into Spain by foot, and drove west along the coast toward a ramshackle house perched above a cliff above the strait to spend a week with him. His house is difficult to pinpoint in the hills above Tarifa, a hippie kite-surfing town at the southernmost tip of mainland Europe. I arrive at the door after getting lost, and a 27-year-old marine biology intern named Maggie cracks it open. De Stefanis isn't home right now, she says. He's at sea. Be careful, De Stefanis had warned a few days earlier on Facebook. The orcas are now in the strait. Maggie isn't sure how long he'll be, but I can wait for him here. A shed snakeskin of a sleeping bag lies on the threadbare couch. A cold wind whistles through a broken window, and cans of energy drinks dot the coffee table. Here we live like Peter Pan, De Stefanis tells me a couple days later. And in a bedroom on the first floor, which is stuffed with toys, including a couple of cuddly killer whales, Maggie points to my bunk. It's DeStefanis' daughter's room. I'm to sleep there while the 9-year-old stays with her mother in Seville. From the top of the house, I can make out the cliffs of the Moroccan coast. A procession of freight ships chugs between the Pillars of Hercules, two promontories that frame the entrance to the Atlantic Ocean, one on the European side and the other in North Africa. For ancient mariners, the two pillars were a warning. Advance no farther. They marked out the edges of the known world and the start of nothingness. According to classical mythology, the Strait of Gibraltar was Hercules' handiwork, 8 miles across at its tightest point. Why would Hercules make it so narrow? Well, to stop sea monsters from coming up into the Mediterranean, wrote Diodorus Siculus, an ancient Greek historian. The protector of mankind had built a bottleneck for blocking civilization off from the wild. There are 3 interns, and they tell me they hardly ever see DeStefanis, despite living in his little house for many months. He has mad scientist vibes, one of them tells me over Tapath. Some days, DeStefanis remains in his bedroom morning to night, announcing, "Today doesn't exist." Or he waits out bad weather and rough swells in his sleeping bag in the living room with an old movie. Gladiator is his favorite. But as soon as conditions are right, he slips out into the strait again, searching for Gladys. Which is what he's doing as I wait, passing the time, trying to decipher a Spanish translation of Moby Dick I find on a shelf in his office, beside crossbow darts used for extracting whale biopsies. That evening, as DeStefanis steps through the door just in time for spaghetti and meatballs, I remember I'd read he was an ex-rugby player. His cetacean obsession had followed a short professional career, and he still has the physique of a feared enforcer. His wet blue eyes are a little bloodshot. They appear to intimidate the interns, who were chattering happily until the moment he walked in. After dinner, DeStefanis kindles a log fire. He tells me about changing ancient seafaring routes, passages sailors had followed since before the ancient Romans. A few months earlier, he had announced that boats should avoid the deep waters in the middle of the strait, where the orcas usually strike. Sailors obeyed, and today most vessels in the area hug the coast. Diverting boats seems to delight him. He stands up and starts pacing the living room. "Super fun," he says. "I like it." Avoiding the hot spots is common sense. If DeStefanis gets such a kick out of rerouting the boats, though, I wonder as I watch him lope around, isn't that something he shares with the killer whales, the creatures that are his life? Everybody seems to be having a great time redirecting sailboats, but are the orcas only having fun, or are the attacks vindictive? The morning of January 10th, 2023, was cloudy and calm on the Strait of Gibraltar. DeStefanis and his team of 5 stepped into an inflatable Zodiac and sped out of Tarifa Harbor in the direction of Morocco, past the Statue of Christ at the port's entrance. It was the first day of their government-funded project to understand how to deter the killer whales. First, though, the crew had to check if they were even around. It was in these waters that once swam the first killer whales to ever be described in writing. The killer whale, a creature that is the enemy of the other species, and the appearance of which can be represented by no other description except that of an enormous mass of flesh with savage teeth, wrote Pliny the Elder in A.D. 77, charges and pierces other whales like warships ramming. But in the winter, killer whales are less common in the Strait of Gibraltar. They often follow the bluefin tuna into the Atlantic, and DeStefanis didn't expect to see them. Standing on the blow-up tube on the side of the boat, he scanned the horizon. He was not ready to begin any experiments. As far as he knew, the orcas never went for inflatable boats. Once in the deep water, though, 2 killer whales started approaching them quickly from behind. Their black and white faces were rhythmically emerging from the water as they swam, their eyes fixed on the boat. The pair got closer and closer until one lifted the Zodiac out of the water with a gentle tap of its nose. Then it happened again. Everybody on the boat was knocked toward the bow. Estefanus's heart was pounding. He worried the orcas would destroy the boat on their first day of work. "I wasn't scared," he tells me with a smirk. "Okay, I was fucking scared." The killer whales played with the blow-up craft for about an hour. Sebastian Lang, a German photographer who lives in Tarifa, had come aboard for the ride. A few years earlier, Lang had been snorkeling at a nearby spot with pilot whales, long black cetaceans with bulbous foreheads that are the only animals Iberian orcas appear to fear. One of them took Lang's arm in its mouth and swam down to the depths, delivering him back to the surface just before he passed out. As the orcas rammed the fragile inflatable, Lang zoned out again, but this time with a feeling of awe. "My brain shut off," he tells me. "I wanted to look at them for hours and hours." DeStefanis powered back to shore at top speed. Over the next few months, he and the team ventured out as often as weather allowed. When a killer whale approached them, he stuck a GPS tracker onto its shiny back. And this location data led to his recommendation that boats should avoid deep water. He experimented with keeping going versus stopping and found that continuing led to fewer and less destructive attacks. A stationary boat, he found, makes for a better target. He tried out a pinger that played a high-pitched sound, which some sailors say repels the whales, and found it seemed to attract them instead. He played recordings of pilot whale calls, but he worried they would drive the orcas out of the strait altogether, so he stopped. He dragged decoy rudders behind the boat to see which designs they preferred, and he deployed a prototype deterrent rudder covered with soft spikes. It appeared to be effective. What he failed to prove, though, was the reason for the behavior. Although what conclusive evidence of that would look like is hard to imagine, still, DeStefanis has a theory. On a bright and clear day a few months later, DeStefanis was approached by a group of orcas, including one with a deep wound gouged into its dorsal fin. It was Gladys Black. DeStefanis shows me underwater video that he had taken with a GoPro attached to a stick. Beneath the boat, Gladys Black rotates into a vertical position and presses and rubs the pointed black tip of his face against the rudder. His face and white chin are covered with scratches and scars. Was he seeking revenge? This theory, it seemed, had originated with Alfredo Lopez, an animal biologist at the University of Aveiro in Portugal. Lopez believes that one of the orcas could have been harmed, perhaps by a fishing line, and that the behavior might be a response to injury. "Complete bullshit," says DeStefanis, who has known Lopez since 1999 through attending whale conferences, and he has little respect for him. "I call him the expert," he says with a mocking smile. "He's no friend of mine." He adds, "He knows that I know that he has never even seen an orca." When I reach out to Lopez, he is too busy to speak with me. His team is inundated with whale carcasses that keep washing up on the coasts, his colleague, Monica Gonzalez, tells me over email. She adds that Lopez had seen wild orcas many times, but that his personal history matters little. It's worth pointing out here that DeStefanis has attracted controversy, too. He has studied the orcas at Loro Park, Spain's version of SeaWorld, which still keeps four animals in captivity. The Conservation Foundation connected to the park has also given him grant money. DeStefanis says he opposes keeping orcas in captivity. "We shouldn't capture any more," he tells me, "but as long as they are there, they can be useful to biologists." Gonzalez tells me that she doesn't care what DeStefanis thinks of Lopez's work. Still, Team Lopez and Team DeStefanis battle it out in Facebook comments, and just as the attacks have become a craze among the orcas, Lopez's trauma and revenge hypothesis quickly became a meme among human onlookers. "Killer whales orchestrating revenge attacks on boats," wrote the New York Post in 2020. "Revenge of the orcas?" asked the Washington Post in May 2023. Every orca researcher I speak to agrees that Lopez's hypothesis is implausible. Even Drion, whose experience with the orcas felt like an attack, compares the whales to a powerful dog playing rough with a small child. "It feels scary, and it's certainly dangerous, but to the dog it's just a game." "If they really wanted to sink the boat," Drion tells me, "they would just jump on it and the game is over." "But the attacks could still be a result of how humans have harmed killer whales," DeStefano says. "In 2010, overfishing decimated the bluefin tuna population, and during that period the orcas birthed fewer calves. With fewer siblings to play with," DeStefanis wonders, "were boisterous juveniles choosing boats as their playmates instead? Okay, but then why are the adults joining in?" "That's not so surprising," he tells me. "Humans aren't so different. His daughter is trying to teach him TikTok dances." Whether or not that story holds water, DeStefanis is convinced Lopez's trauma and revenge idea is wrong. The behavior is play through and through. But as DeStefanis fills the house with chaos, shouting and blasting Independence Day at 8 a.m., I can't shake the idea that this interpretation, that it's nothing but horseplay, overlaps almost too neatly with what he himself seems to share with the orcas. His connection to killer whales has zero to do with what people sometimes talk about after swimming with dolphins. It has nothing mystical about it, nothing to do with wisdom, intuition, or serenity. What he shares with the animals is a rambunctious physicality, brute strength, friskiness, fluid rhythms of attention. He keeps reminding me of an unruly juvenile. Is there a chance he could be wrong? When pushed, he admits he can't rule out the trauma and revenge theory completely. There is, he estimates, a 5% chance that it's true. In any case, the probability is not zero. "Never," he tells me. "I'm a scientist." Still, DeStefanis is probably right. If the orcas do intend to destroy boats and harm people on them, they could do that easily by smashing holes in the hull, but they never do. They are obsessed only with the rudder. And the idea that the behavior developed in reaction to an injury from a fishing line, or even because of overfishing, is dubious, because the orcas very rarely, to our knowledge, attack fishing boats, for unclear reasons. More than that, though, is the fact that every killer whale scientist I speak to repeats the same thing. These creatures just don't carry vendettas. "Orcas have one of the most elaborated brains on the planet," says Lori Marino, a neuroscientist, expert in whale behavior, and founder and president of the Whale Sanctuary Project. "An orca's cerebral cortex is more convoluted, more intricately folded than a human's, which gives them an extraordinary ability to learn, remember, think, and feel. Killer whales lead a rich emotional life and share some complex feelings with humans," Marino says. "They experience empathy, they mourn their dead, and they are probably smart enough to understand why an individual might want to harm another in vengeance, to impart a lesson, for example, or to discourage future attacks, which makes it even more remarkable that, in the wild, orcas never do. In the 1960s and 1970s, when orcas in the northeastern Pacific were repeatedly terrorized by boats that kidnapped their relatives and put them into captivity, they never attacked vessels of any kind. Unlike highly intelligent terrestrial mammals such as chimps, gorillas, or humans, there is very little evidence that wild killer whales have ever sought revenge. Although orcas in captivity have killed trainers, those animals were probably psychologically disturbed by their environment," says Marino. When a chimpanzee steals food, the victim often retaliates. An aggrieved macaque will settle scores, sometimes attacking a family member of the perpetrator. But orcas don't do that. They have adapted in a way that eliminates the need for aggression, says Deborah Giles, a killer whale researcher at the University of Washington. I wanted to speak with Hal Whitehead, the co-author of The Cultural Lives of Whales and Dolphins, a book that gripped me for days. Over Zoom, I asked Whitehead, who is a professor of biology at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, why orcas might have evolved to not hold grudges against other animals. He explains that while land mammals can be territorial, territory isn't really a thing in the sea. With few fixed resources in the ocean, there's less to go to war about. It's fluid, it's flexible. Animals are moving around here and there, he says. And perhaps, now Whitehead is musing, we can learn something from that. Some of us think that aggression and war are inevitable, he tells me. But if sophisticated forms of ocean intelligence can teach complex land-bound brains a lesson, he says, it is that more equal ways of dividing up resources across territories could make war and aggression less likely. What looks like revenge against humans, Whitehead says, is a behavior that may be a kind of culture, a way this community of orcas now strengthens its group identity. Orca obsessions can quickly turn into collective fads. Take their eating habits. Most wild animals are not fussy gourmands, but the orcas that live in the seas around Antarctica eat tiny penguins, and when they kill them, they discard everything other than the breast muscles. Orcas that eat other whales usually enjoy only the lips and the tongue and leave the rest to wash up or rot. Each community of killer whales speaks its own dialect, and off the coast of Australia, in a place called Shark Bay, orcas adorn their noses with ornamental sponges. In the 1980s, the salmon-eating orcas of the northeastern Pacific fashioned hats from the carcasses of their prey. They wore them all summer. Outside of humans, the complexity and stability of these cultural forms is unparalleled. Boat ramming is just the latest of these practices. But when we, another eminent cultural animal, seek to understand what killer whales are up to, we can't help but see them through the pinhole of our own cultural practices and group dynamics. We look beneath the surface with ape eyes, and we see territoriality and retaliation where we should see cultural behaviors that have little to do with land-based violence, which results in orcas with ape-like vendettas going viral. For most of my day with DeStephanis, the ocean is too rough to go out upon. On my last day, though, there's a window of calm, and he wants to show me the orcas before I leave. I offer to drive us to the port in my rental car. He thinks I'll probably drive too slowly, and bombs down the hill on his motorbike. At the port, we meet a man named Salva, who will control the boat while DeStephanis scans the surface for fins. We hop onto the Zodiac, motor past the Jesus statue and out into the strait, and squint into the horizon until our faces hurt. We see hundreds of silvery dolphins breach and spin in the air. We see a pod of pilot whales and a languid sunfish drifting on the surface. We see a yacht in the distance between a stream of cargo ships underway in deep water. The captain is resisting DeStephanis' advice. That could get him into trouble, says DeStephanis. But the yacht will be lucky. The killer whales are nowhere to be seen. They are probably already hunting tuna in the open ocean. Perhaps, I think, they've abandoned their craze. Maybe they've even developed a new fixation. I drive back to Gibraltar feeling a little deflated, and while I wait for my flight, I walk up the European Pillar of Hercules. Near the top, a sign warns me about macaques, the only wild monkeys that live on the continent, which may behave aggressively. For a few minutes, I watch them lounging peacefully in the sun, then turn around and fly home. But 2 months later, the orcas, fresh from the open seas, swim back into the Strait of Gibraltar. At dusk on February 4th, their fad, apparently now their tradition, a way of life, 5 individuals begin to ram the back of a large sailing boat in rough seas 6 miles off the coast of Tangiers. "We saw them heading straight for us," says the French captain. "Aggressive and lively and very fast." It's the first incident in the strait of what is sure to be a perilous season. For the orcas, it marks the start of a fun-filled spring. I'm your volunteer reader, Steve Godwin, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this hour, we're reading from Rolling Stone magazine. "I'll admit I blew it." Michael Richards talks Kramer, Vietnam, and that racist outburst. By Nick Hilden. When Michael Richards' most well-known character, Kramer, erupted through the door on on-screen neighbor Jerry Seinfeld 35 years ago, he also burst into the homes of audiences everywhere, finding fast acclaim for his madcap antics and refreshing lack of filter. At the time, he and his castmates were waging what Seinfeld has called the sacred mission of comedy. That mission, Richards tells Rolling Stone, was to get the laugh. Like Jason seeking the golden fleece, to seek the ha-ha. That's the big treasure, and that's ultimately what we were after together. It was quite a journey. By the end of Seinfeld in 1998, that journey had elevated Richards to the status of cultural icon. But then, in 2006, his onstage outburst of racist slurs shouted at a predominantly black audience effectively closed the book on his career as a public entertainer. In his new autobiography, Entrances and Exits, Richards charts the path through his early career as an aspiring actor, comedian, and spiritual seeker in the 1960s and 1970s, to his first major small-screen foray with the early 80s sketch comedy show Fridays, which also happened to be his first collaboration with writer and future Seinfeld co-creator Larry David, to the creation of Kramer and his ascension to a household name, and the infamous end to it all. Along the way, he delves into the absurdity of his military service during the Vietnam War, divulges his mother's painful secret about the assault that resulted in his conception, and ponders the aftermath of his disastrous exit from show business and the lifetime of untreated rage that may have contributed to his explosive, ignominious finale. "Most of the characters I conjure up don't want to be there, just like me," Richards writes about his relationship to the world in Entrances and Exits. "They're angry and rowdy, a clown in the night." And indeed, the story of Michael Richards is one of humor and anger, good and ill, rise and fall. "There's a light to it and a dark to it," he tells Rolling Stone. "But it's all of what each of us has to face." The rest of this is in an interview format, and it has been edited for length and clarity. "Michael, why did you decide it was time to write a book?" "I wrote the book because I'm 75 years old this July, and I got cancer a few years ago. I've had an interesting life, some tough times, and some real blessings, and I wanted to leave my book as a legacy." "How did your cancer diagnosis impact you?" "At first, I just thought it was my time to go. I talk about entrances and exits a lot in my book. You know, we're living and dying all the time. I'm in and out of things daily. But with my then 8-year-old son, I felt I'd sure like to be around for him. And I'm thinking, well, this is my time to go. But at the same time, I didn't think I was going anywhere. Like when I was drafted for the Vietnam War, I just knew I wasn't going to die in combat. How did I know that? I'm not saying I can see around corners. I just knew it wasn't my time to die. So here I am with prostate cancer. If it spreads anymore, adios. I had to go through surgery and all went well. What's my outlook now? I'm aware of my age these days. I spend a lot of time outdoors in the Santa Monica Mountains. I feel connected to the earth, moon, and sun. You write that you enjoyed your time in the military when most people were trying to avoid it at all costs due to the war. I was the kind of guy that was wide open to things, and I wanted to go into the service to see what it was all about. That's ultimately why I went in. I was very, very curious. There was the Vietnam War going on, and people were being killed. A lot of people weren't up for the war. They were questioning why we were in a war. But for me, I just saw it as an adventure, and that was it. I was up for the adventure. There are photos in the book where you look like a pretty long-haired guy for the Army. Did you see the contradiction? You as both the avant-garde freak comedian and the military man? I just see them all interrelated. The world is a stage. I had long hair at the time because I was coming off of a production that I was doing at Cal Arts. I let my hair grow long, and I kept it long for the summer. A lot of people had long hair and were letting it all hang out. In the book, you proclaim, "Hail to the irrational." What do you mean by that? When I speak of the irrational, I speak of the mistake. And comedy deals a lot with the mistake, a comedy of error. With the irrational, usually things come up that we weren't expecting. We can't see around corners, can we? So it's always the unexpected. Is there another path a young Michael Richards could have taken if he hadn't become an actor or comedian? I suppose if I didn't do comedy and if I hadn't gotten into working as an actor, I probably would have been a wanderer. As an artist, you wander about. Like in Building Kramer for Seinfeld, there was a wandering. It took probably about 13 episodes of wandering about and the putting together that character. The right clothes and brooding over this and that and thinking of ways in which to build an entire character. The voice, the look, the mannerisms, all the tics. It's all carefully calculated, but it takes a lot of wandering to get there. Were there moments where you really knew you got it? Definitely. I knew that through the audience. I hear the laughs, and then I'm starting to feel it. That assists me. It was really great because we did most of the show before a live audience. On my first show, Fridays, when I started, it was a great vehicle for building characters very, very quickly. A few days, that's all you get. Line changes right up to camera. It's live. I mean, you're really swinging out there. What a training field that was for me. I really began to listen to the audience. They'll let you know. Did you ever lose yourself in a character? Oh, yeah. I could be in character, and when I was outside a character, I was uncomfortable because I didn't know myself well enough. But when I was in character, it was safe. In the book, you discuss how you're an introvert who sometimes had trouble with interviews or in certain social settings, which is surprising considering that your best-known character seemed to be the exact opposite. Was it hard coming up as an introvert whose job was literally to stand on a stage in front of an audience? Oh, I was absolutely fine being on stage in character. Coming out as myself, being Michael Richards, that's another story. And one that I tussle with throughout the book. As far as interviews and red carpet events go, it was hard for me to be natural. I would hide behind antics, screw around, and not settle down into the question I was being asked. I had my persona, you know, dressing up, looking good. Hi, how are you? Nice to be here. Good to see you. But overall, I felt I had to perform, entertain people, always be on. To just be myself, that's like doing nothing. Nobody's interested in nothing. Do you think you changed as a person and comedian through your experience on Seinfeld? Was the Michael Richards who went into it the same Michael Richards who came out? I did change during Seinfeld, big time. I was no longer just an actor. I was famous now. And everywhere I went, I was Kramer. I mean, everywhere. It's Kramer, Kramer. I'm still like this, and I'm cool with it. The K-Man is still coming through the door, but you see, back then, Seinfeld was my third TV show. Professionally, I was working steadily for over 20 years, and before this, I'd been in and around acting since I was 14. Acting was all I thought about. But after Seinfeld, I felt I needed a break from it all. I just felt like I wanted to sit for 5 years out in the wilderness in a small stone cabin reading great books by a fire. I started to make that dream come true and bought a huge parcel of land in the Sierras. I was on my way out. But then I was getting offers, and some so huge I couldn't say no. Also, I began to worry that if I didn't take another job, I wouldn't work again. I had that actor in me saying, "Where's my next part? To be or not to be, you know?" For a while there, I didn't know which way to go. I was in my mid-50s and probably having a midlife crisis. Rage is a persistent theme throughout your book. Was that intentional? Anger on stage is something we explore as comics. It takes years to work with anger, which is within us all. So it's quite a process to move that into the ha-ha. We've seen it all throughout humanity. The rage, the war, the conflict. That's part of the color of my fur, of everyone's fur, isn't it? By the time Seinfeld ended, you were riding high as one of the most acclaimed figures in entertainment. And then, in 2006, you basically destroyed it in a single moment with your infamously racist eruption at the Laugh Factory. What was it like to go from being this widely embraced cultural figure to having everyone step back from you? Well, I stepped back from myself. It was a catalyst for moving into deeper places in myself. It was a way of learning more about myself, which is a big task for us all, to know thyself. In the book, you wrote, "I certainly can't explain my comedic process and how I cut loose on a comedy club stage. It will sound ridiculous and defensive." Can you explain it now? I was actually using anger, thinking I could get a laugh out of it all. But I just didn't come through, that's it. It was just a bad night. You work late at night, and you go through material, and you go through an exchange with the audience. You hope you can move it into humor, but it didn't come through that night. A few days later, you apologized on Letterman and said that you had a lot of personal work to do. What did that work end up looking like? I wanted to make an apology, but I'd already had it in mind that I was going to take an exodus. I really felt like I think that I'm going to put all this down and get back to myself. I went into analysis for years and worked closely with my dreams, and I was discovering a lot about myself, more than ever. And I think the club incident was a catalyst for going into some real deep personal work. I was open for it. Do you want to be forgiven? I had to start by forgiving myself, first of all, and that's why I took off. I can't clear it up for everyone out there. They're going to have to work with it in their own way. I'm not out here seeking to be forgiven, but I'll admit that I blew it. It was a bad night. What people want to do with that, that's up to them. But I know what I have to do with it, and that's more important because I have to live with myself every day. They don't live with me every day. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. Why Are People Promoting Raw Milk? By Elizabeth Yuko. The sound of mooing rang out in the chambers of the Louisiana Capitol when the House unanimously voted in favor of a bill legalizing the sale of raw milk in the state. HB 467 also passed in the state Senate. And if Republican Governor Jeff Landry signs it into law as expected, Louisiana will join the vast majority of other states where unpasteurized milk can be bought and sold legally, provided the label warns that it's not for human consumption and potentially contains harmful bacteria. But as Louisiana lawmakers have pointed out, the label isn't going to prevent raw milk enthusiasts from drinking it anyway. If anything, there's been a recent surge of raw milk evangelism among conservatives, anti-establishment figures like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the trade wives and homesteaders on social media, and their patron saint, Gwyneth Paltrow, who says she drinks raw cream in her coffee every morning. While their unapologetic espousal of unpasteurized milk isn't new, the debate, unlike the unprocessed dairy products, has been particularly heated since the H5N1 avian influenza virus was first detected in U.S. dairy cows back in March, prompting the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Food and Drug Administration, and National Institutes of Health to issue warnings against drinking raw milk. Things began to boil over last week, thanks in part to the discovery that Charlie Kirk's right-wing youth organization, Turning Point USA, had been selling Got Raw Milk t-shirts that featured an illustration of a bull, not a cow. The image on the t-shirt has since been updated. But if you haven't been keeping up with crunchy TikTok, the right's latest attempt to undermine public health might appear to have come from nowhere. Here's what to know about raw milk, including what people are claiming about it, whether it's safe to drink, and why the dairy aisle has become the site of the MAGA crowd's most recent anti-science battle. Why are people talking about raw milk? When people talk about raw milk, they're referring to milk that comes directly from a cow's udder and has not been heat-treated or pasteurized, says Brian Kuo Lee, Ph.D., a food scientist, food industry consultant, and a faculty research fellow in the Department of Chemistry at Pacific Lutheran University. According to James Fitzgerald, Ph.D., associate professor of security studies at Dublin City University, whose research focuses on conspiracy-led violent extremism, post-truth politics, and disinformation, the consumption of raw milk is the latest in a long line of social and political markers that sets the extreme right apart, giving it a distinct identity as an alternative way of seeing and raging at the world. Other examples include alternative diets, self-help, and bodily improvement trends. While drinking unpasteurized milk isn't illegal, it does go against the official guidance of federal agencies like the CDC and FDA, as well as mainstream medical expertise, as we saw with extreme right and conservative resistance to vaccination during the COVID-19 pandemic, Fitzgerald tells Rolling Stone. It provides individuals with a sense of agency, of freedom and control. One of the reasons why the topic taps into broad support among individuals who may not otherwise support far or extreme right causes. Along the same lines, Celine Gounder, M.D., an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at New York University and Bellevue Hospital, and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News, explains that for many people, promoting the consumption of unpasteurized milk is a political statement. She compared the situation to one she encountered as an aid worker in Guinea during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa roughly a decade ago. When people refuse to wash their hands as a form of political resistance. The rise in the popularity of raw dairy products is also likely a symptom of the current state of healthcare in the country. People don't trust the American healthcare system, and with good reason, Gounder tells Rolling Stone. It's first and foremost about profit, not caring for patients or cultivating a healthy population. When people are poorly served by the healthcare system, because it's too expensive, inaccessible, discriminatory, difficult to navigate, or unfriendly, Gounder says they seek alternatives, like consuming raw milk, that give them a sense of control. Why do people think raw milk is good for you? So, what exactly do people think of the benefits of drinking raw milk? Some, like Clint Rary, the owner of a farm that produces raw milk, claim that it's healthier than pasteurized milk because you're not killing out all the bacteria that you need to be consuming from it. It's actually real food that hasn't been altered or genetically modified, he explained on an April episode of InfoWars War Room with Owen Schroyer podcast. More specifically, TikTok user at Barnbell Sophie, a self-described woman built for the kitchen and urban homesteader, claims in a post that raw milk contains way more vitamins, minerals, and even healthy fats compared to pasteurized milk and has been shown to have great effects for autoimmune diseases, asthma, and sometimes even eczema. Disturbingly, by April 29th, there were evidently enough people who thought that consuming raw milk contaminated with live A H5N1 virus was a good way to develop antibodies against the disease that the CDC determined it was necessary to issue a food safety advisory, explaining why that was a bad idea. For others, it's part of a natural lifestyle. But as Gounder puts it, drinking raw milk is about as natural as drinking water contaminated with raw sewage. Pasteurization is no more unnatural than cooking, refrigerating, or freezing food. We do all of these things to make food safer to consume. What are the health risks associated with drinking raw milk? Although there's not conclusive evidence of the health benefits of drinking unpasteurized milk, the risks are well documented. Between 2009 and 2014, raw milk and cheese, which are only consumed by 3.2% and 1.6% of the U.S. population, respectively, are responsible for causing 96% of illnesses from dairy contamination, according to a 2017 study in Emerging Infectious Diseases, a peer-reviewed journal published by the CDC. Prior to the widespread introduction of commercial pasteurization in urban areas in the early 1900s, milk-borne illnesses including diphtheria, tuberculosis, and summer diarrhea were a major threat to public health. The number of pathogens in raw milk is thousands or tens of thousands of times more than pasteurized milk, Lee explains. Pasteurization is essential to reduce the number of pathogens to a level that is acceptable for the vast majority of the population to drink safely, especially those who may have a compromised immune system. While several recent public health advisories have focused on the presence of H5N1 avian influenza virus in raw milk, Gounder says that people who drink unpasteurized milk also risk contracting E. coli, salmonella, and campylobacter bacterial infections, which are often accompanied by unpleasant symptoms like fever, diarrhea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. These bacteria are present in the feces of cattle, and the undersides of cattle are highly contaminated with them, she explains. But that's not all. E. coli infections may also cause hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS, which, according to Gounder, is characterized by damage to blood vessels, blood clots, and kidney failure, accompanied by a drop in both red cells and platelets. Raw milk may also contain meningitis-causing Listeria bacteria, which may cause symptoms including headache, stiff neck, confusion, and seizures. Infection during pregnancy can be highly morbid and fatal for a fetus or a newborn, Gounder adds. So what is the end goal of the raw milk movement? Given the potential risks of drinking raw milk, why are right-wing extremists, wellness influencers, and anti-establishment leaders encouraging others to guzzle it down? One reason, according to Fitzgerald, is that it helps to bolster other far and extreme right conspiracy theories, like the Great Reset, which is based on the idea that a globalist elite is pushing an agenda to remove meat and dairy products from modern diets and replace them with plant-based and lab-grown alternatives. At a minimum, this would infringe on individual freedom of choice, he explains. At worst, it would allow liberal globalist elites to contaminate new sources of food with chemicals and additives designed to pacify the masses, who would become apathetic to political change. In addition to potential political gain, there are also financial incentives. Influencers make money from peddling snake oils, sometimes actually selling products, sometimes trading on the size of their audiences, Gounder says. But social media content is the real moneymaker. Influencers, for example, need to push out new content on a regular basis to hold the interest of their listener base and, in turn, generate a higher share of advertising revenue, Fitzgerald says. Lastly, drinking unpasteurized milk also provides another way for the extreme right to embrace idealized aesthetics of the past, alongside traditional gender roles and policies that maintain and promote the status quo of white supremacy. The consumption of raw milk, like the tradwife aesthetic, which is also leveraged by the extreme right, is a lifestyle choice that harkens back to a better, simpler time when traditional social hierarchies persist, Fitzgerald explains. So while those promoting the consumption of unpasteurized dairy have set their sights on returning to a simpler time, all that raw milk is probably going to offer is an achy gut or something much worse. And with that cheery thought, I'm going to have to leave you because that's all for tonight. We've reached the end of our hour. You've been listening to selected articles or portions of articles from the online edition of Rolling Stone magazine. I'm your volunteer reader, Steve Godwin, and as always, it's been my pleasure to read them for you. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College. Remember, if you miss a program or even part of a program here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Just left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.